Welcome to the Chalk Talk Gym podcast, where we explore insights into healthcare that help uncover new opportunities for growth and success. I'm your host, Jim Jordan. Welcome back to the show. Today, our guest is Dr. Harvey Castro, and he's a visionary physician and entrepreneur at the forefront of the artificial intelligence revolution in medicine. With 20 years of ER experience, Dr. Castro brings unique perspective. He's not only managed hospitals and emergency rooms, but he's also actually founded his own healthcare system. His passion for leveraging technology to improve patient care led him to become really a pioneer in the field of artificial intelligence in healthcare. He's authored over 15 books, from diagnostic tools and predictive analytics to virtual assistants and robotics. Dr. Castro is paving the way for a future where AI and human expertise work hand in hand to develop exceptional care and optimize healthcare outcomes, but importantly, bring the human touch back into the relationship. Join us as we delve into the transformational potential of artificial intelligence and its impact on the evolving landscape of healthcare business models, products, and innovations. Dr. Castro, tell me and the audience a little bit more about yourself.
Bit of a nutty professor in that I have a lot of the different portions of healthcare. Obviously, the frontline work, literally locations, and I literally was managing doctors, managing a brand, and then as well as having my own marketing and then billing and then staffing for it. And so that gave me a lot of information on how to look at it from a CEO's point of view or that angle. And then the last, it was, and this all describes who I am, it was November 2022. I'm literally playing with ChatGPT and I think, oh my God, this is going to change medicine. This is going to help so many people. It's going to help physicians and healthcare professional burnout. And I thought to myself, literally, I've been typing on the first time within minutes, I said, I'm going to write a book about this. I literally went running to my wife. I'm like, hey, I'm writing this book on ChatGPT. And she's looking at me like, what are you talking about? And then I was explaining it to her and she started chuckling. She's no one's going to listen to you. No one's going to understand this. This is like way too advanced. It's not going to catch. And I was like, So I said, you know what? I stalled for a week. And then after that, I was like, I'm going to write the book. And fast forward, I literally wrote the first book on ChatGPT and healthcare.
So tell us, when did it go out and where could people find it?
Yeah. So that book went out January 2023 and you can find it on Amazon. Since then, I've written probably over 15 different books on AI in healthcare, AI in crime, solving different cold cases using AI. And I'm having a lot of fun. Actually, this was not prompted, but I have these books next to me. And this one's the latest one. It's How to Use the Apple Vision Pro and AI in healthcare. Because I'm just really passionate about these different types of technology. And all of them are also on Amazon.
So that's a lot. Let's pause and take a moment. Where do you think AI is going to fit in healthcare in general at this phase in time and maybe in the future? Because obviously you've got the goggles there too at the same time.
Yeah, I see it two flavors. We have in AI, basically I see it as two worlds. We have the structured data and unstructured. And just to break it down to something simple, think of it as AI, everybody's heard of it in radiology. It reads x-rays, it's seeing CAT scans, it's helping. But what we really haven't seen much of is how's it working inside the electronic medical record? What is it doing? How's it helping patients? We're really accustomed to seeing all these algorithms for x-rays. And so to answer your question, what do I see? I see that's going to continue to grow, but now the rest of medicine is going to start to adapt. And so when I look at the rest of medicine, I look at both the patient and then the physicians. And so within the different verticals of medicine, AI is going to be used a little bit easier versus others. For example, the big one is family practice has really not adapted AI, whereas other parts of medicine have. For example, the administrations of all the hospitals are really now looking at these tools of, let me help with patients. Can we create a bot that's going to help me create a schedule? Can we create different billing codes and send it quicker to the insurance companies? And so what I'm seeing now is a shift towards, let's use this type of technology and let's use it for that repetitive work. And so that's the first low-hanging fruit. The simplest example is I'm looking at this keyboard right here. And can you imagine if I never had to use this again in the hospital? How many times have you seen your doctor literally look away from you typing because that's where the computer's at, but really it's the doctor should be facing you. And so automatically, this is old technology, and sadly, it's not being used enough. But the simple transcription of AI going through this conversation and then putting it into the EMR. And so that's the next phase that I'm embarrassed to say that hospitals are still using fax machines. If they're still using fax machines, then this is sometimes revolutionary for some of the hospital systems.
So I think when I break down AI and where its risks and rewards are, I, like you, think this is administrative side where really if we get something wrong, it's not life or death, right? Whereas obviously in the clinical setting, it is can be life and death. So I think that's going to accelerate. And then I think when I look inside of the hospital, you really see it in what I would call closed loop systems like radiology PACS. You don't see it going horizontal yet. And I think that the AI that's there, even though it's been there, it's been perceived as a tool and not as a decision maker, meaning let me scan this, let me get some insights. You think of robotics, right? How do I do minimally invasive surgery? You and I were talking before we started recording this great company called Augmetics that does, you know, virtual reality for spine procedure. And when you realize what they do, the patient gets on the table, you have a plan and you have to move the patient. And all of a sudden that plan is not working, right? And it gets adjusted automatically. And it makes you even wonder how orthopedics ever really was so successful when they really are doing everything without this technology. So I think that the fear factor to me, as I talk to people, is this AI making clinical decisions. Do you agree with those three boxes I made?
And oh yeah, I definitely do. And I'm going to throw a curveball for you to also subdivide. I hate generalizing because generalizing is not good, but I see it as follows. Depending what part of the country you're talking to and who the age group that you're talking to will also determine your AI widget per se.
Yes.
If you and I were in Silicon Valley, man, people would be like hugging us, high-fiving us, let's go. But I'm going to pick in Texas because I'm in Texas. If I pick East Texas and certain parts that are really remote and I go in saying, hey, I want to do this at your hospital, the administrators will eat my lunch. They will say no. Right. I've had some doctors get so upset with me saying, AI is the devil. And if this ends up at my hospital, I'm going to retire. And there's a lot of fear in this technology. So I'm personally taking it upon me to just go out there and talk about the good, the bad, and the unknown of AI and healthcare and how to implement it because of this reason.
It's funny, but the dean of Hines College, his name is Krishnan. He does AI stuff at the White House. Absolutely brilliant gentleman. And one of the things that he talks about is technology is often more advanced than the policies, laws, and regulations that support it. So I think part of that fear is there's always been that the physician is the final decision maker. And if a physician has a technical issue during a procedure, there's always these review committees, and the review committees have people on it with judgment too, right? And they talk about, did you follow what are the recommended protocols? And if you deviated, why? And tell us about your judgment. And I think that one of the fears is that's just going to be a black and white, and you make a decision, and now all of a sudden you're going to be fighting some artificial intelligence engine that, quite frankly, we don't have any rules and regulations yet on what's in those engines. So I think that the FDA is sorting through that. I think we have intellectual property law that's going to be sorted through that, because if I have to tell you what's in my engine, that's my proprietary stuff. But the reality is probably mostly not protected because it's input. And so I think you had your Apple book there with your vision. So what's your next step?
Yeah, as we move forward, going back to my analogy that different verticals are going to be using AI differently. And to your point on the Apple Vision Pro, literally the first day that the Apple Vision Pro came out, it was being used for neurosurgery. And so we already seen some verticals just quickly be early adapters to say, we're going to use this tool, let's go. And so that's where I see the Apple Vision Pro. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, it's cost prohibitive to do certain things. But depending on the vertical of your hospital, how you're using it, it actually may be cost effective. And there might be enough money, for example, in a neurosurgery department, there's money there to be spent because their profit margins are pretty large. They can't afford to have this in their OR.
So I'm not familiar with that story. Tell us what they're using it for.
Yeah. So the Apple Vision Pro, I'm starting to see different surgeons using it. I use the example of the neurosurgeon because that's the first example that I ever saw. And just to keep it simple, imagine I'm doing surgery. My hands are sterile. I got to keep it above my heart and I'm working and making sure my hands are clean. And then I'm doing surgery. If I need to look at something, say I'm working on your back and I need to know exactly I'm putting an injection or working on you, I need to be able to visualize it. Imagine if I could, in virtual screen, 100-inch screen, being able to see your CAT scan in real time as I'm looking at you and I'm able to see it, but really big and magnify it. And then imagine if I can take your structure and just with my hands make the motion of rotating and then I'm able to see it. And then imagine if I could take a picture and say, take a picture of this wound that I'm closing or I just want to make sure. And let's say I blow it up. Because you see all these surgeons with those little glasses that they're trying to make it see. Imagine being able to put the Apple Vision Pro and just verbally tell it, make it bigger, smaller, rotate. And so now...
I think you can see through that. That's the super sauce.
Yes, I forgot to mention. Yeah. Yes, sir, yeah. I forgot. Yes, so the Apple Vision Pro has a see-through and it's nanoseconds delay, but your brain won't notice. But I've been using it. In fact, I'm the first person in the world at a HIMSS conference to stand up on stage and use the Apple Vision Pro while I'm giving a talk. Because I can see through it, which is funny walking around through it because some people think I'm going to bump into them or I can't see through it.
I think that's having been involved in a couple robotic startups. When you work with physicians and you talk about the specifications, one of the challenges has been that the physicians say, I never want my eyes to have to leave the surgery site. I never want to have to, in theory, look up or take a second because every moment that I'm not like focused on that is risk. So obviously they stop what they're doing and they're used to looking up at fluoroscopy screens or whatever. But I think the point you're bringing up is, wow, you can actually meet that vision. And it's always been a specification that we could never 100% solve, right? With robotics and stuff, because we have great visual systems, but you had to look at another screen. You had this emergency room experience. How did you get this adaptation? First of all, you're an emergency room person, which is a different personality in and of itself. But you tell us about a time when you've adapted these strategies to get here, where you went from being in an ER to running an organization to doing what you're doing now.
I see myself as a true scientist, and I'm really passionate about stuff that I do. So if I see a pain point, something that I think can be improved, or even if I don't think it can be improved, but I'm passionate about the problem and I want to fix it, then I literally jump in. And so that type of personality has always been in my DNA. When I was 16, I didn't have money for a car, didn't have money for college. So I literally started my own company. And that company that I started was selling vitamins and I would make money on the margin. And I created all this passive income to the point where I paid for my first car, my insurance company back in New York City, which was expensive for a male that was 16. But to the point, give you a quick example. I was in the emergency room coding a patient. I'm literally holding the iPhone 1 in my hand, thinking, working with the nurse. I'm like, hey, this person's crashing. We need to start this IV drip. Just 1 second, doc. Went and got a textbook, started thumbing around, looking, saying, okay, yeah, I got it. Let me get a calculator. Okay, got it. And I'm looking at her thinking, man, 1 seconds count. This is not good. Mm-hmm. So I literally took it upon myself to learn how to program. I created the first IV med app in the world and I pushed it out and it went viral. Every place around the world was buying it left and right. But because I saw a problem, something needed to be done, and I did it. Fast forward when I created all these ERs, same issue. I, as a doctor, my passion is to serve others, help patients. And then I won't say where I was working, but the administration there was like, hey, we need you to work faster and we need you to push more and we need you to order less so that our profit margins were higher. And I would look at them and thinking, I didn't sign up to do that. I signed up to help the patient. That doesn't equate in my brain to do that. And I would call them out. I'm like, look at my average. I'm not like below average. If anything, I feel like I'm above average. And so that upset me to the point where I said, you know what? Luckily in Texas had these things called freestanding ERs. And I said, I'm going to start building these. And then I built about 20 of them and 8 of them I packaged and put them as one brand. And I said, now I'm going to teach doctors how I think medicine should be done. And it went really well. And again, it went to some, my personality of here's a pain point, but something's not right. Let me see what I can do to help.
Now, do you still have those practices or did you?
No, I exit out of them. And now I'm 100% on AI and healthcare. I'm just so passionate about this field. I feel like the more I can personally create products, put them out in the market, teach doctors, help patients, the more I feel like I'm doing more for people than just one clinic, one ER visit.
So when you work with clients, what would you say is their general beginning status of knowledge of AI? Because one of the things that's striking when I work with some of the universities on the medical curriculum for medical school, and you start talking about that there's more teamwork, there's more digital health, and how do we get those courses in? But then you recognize at the same time, you need the physician to know what they generally know. So a lot of times these pieces of education are going to probably happen after. When you're running after reimbursement codes as a physician, you really don't have a lot of time to be able to do these things. So What's the profile of your client that's curious about this?
Yeah, it's literally the bell curve. It's really interesting because, using my bad analogy again, if I'm speaking to someone out in California, they have a different idea of AI and what they want versus other parts of the countries. When they call, they literally call me and say, hey, we need you to come talk to our staff because this is a real case. Our particular state didn't want to have driver's license for the longest time because they don't want identifiers. The hospital administrators know that AI is coming, but they have no idea of anything. They literally want you to come in and just tell them where it is today, where it is tomorrow. And if you can, don't use the words AI because it scares them. That's where we're at. But then I've had other hospital systems call me and say, hey, Harvey, we have a particular problem and we want to use AI. Can you come and just tell us what tools are out there that could help us solve our problem? And then I've had other hospitals that say, okay, hospital across the street just implemented this way of AI. Can you come in and help us create something to that we can be competitive with that other hospital?
Fantastic. So how many clients are you serving at this point in time? How many people are?
We've done over 10 different clients that have called us to do this kind of stuff. I'm really selective too of who I'm working with because there's two sides of this. Sometimes some of the companies are really small and they're also startup phase outside of the hospital that are wanting to get into the hospital. They're wanting for me to talk with them. And some of the startups are, in my opinion, going into the wrong field when it comes to AI. For example, they are like, oh, electronic medical record. I want to create my own. And I'm like, you got Epic, you have other players. Like, really, if you want to do it, probably Epic, if you had an amazing idea, would want to buy you out immediately or just make their own. Not to call out any particular, I was just saying it off the cuff. So I'm also working with different startups and saying, okay, this idea would work, this would not. But having that doctor and entrepreneur spirit, I am creating a lot of things on my own with my business partner, Suffer HR and AI. We're creating different communication tools for hospital systems. At the end of the day, I'm just having fun using this technology. How can I help patients? How can I do more?
And I think when you read up on the state of the physician today, and I have a website called Healthcare Data Center where people could find this report out there, but it talks about the amount of administrative time, the emotional exhaustion that physicians are having. And it's generally not patient-facing issues. It's more associated with paperwork and flow and things like that. And so it seems to me that is the lowest fruit. And it's a ways off before I think physicians have to worry about autonomy. I think what they can do right now is get their time back and their precious time with the patient. What are the resources that you follow to keep current on this that you could share with people if they want to try to catch up here?
Yeah, I do want to backtrack for your statement about physicians and efficiency. I 100% agree. These tools will give patients back time, but I'm going to play devil's advocate and say, if our new standard, let's just pretend we see 2.5 patients per hour, but now through AI, let's just pretend we can see 4. And then you're like, you're seeing more, you're not really spending more time. That's one issue. The other is, I foresee hospital systems and insurance companies going back and saying, hey, this is now the new threshold if you want to get the same reimbursement. And so will the doctor end up having more time with the patient? I'm worried that maybe not. So I just want to say that.
Yeah, no, because I think it's there's a whole health policy debate we could have, right? I think when you sit down and you look at the cash flow margins of a hospital system, a physician practice, and then an insurance company, you will say, why are the people that are watching making more profit than the people that are doing? And yeah. I think that's a policy reconciliation. And I think it's going to end up being, you're starting to see physician practices leave the groups that they joined. When High Tech Act came, a lot of people said, okay, I can't afford this tech, I'm going to be bought out. And they were swayed into joining bigger groups. And the promises of joining those bigger groups have not happened. And so it's very interesting to me as I interview physician practices more in the urban areas right now, they're starting to spin out on their own. And okay, now I can get my electronic health record in the cloud. I don't need IT. I don't need a cybersecurity expert. So now I can take my power back. And I can see where physician groups are now starting to control certain regions of the country and say no to the insurance company, and their negotiation power is going up. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch that play out. But I think the priorities of where the money's going is, I'll say, ass backwards. It really is. I never swear in this podcast, but I think that's appropriate. So if people wanted to follow you, where would they go?
I jokingly say I live on LinkedIn. So I would invite you to come to LinkedIn, just simply type in Harvey Castro, MD. With that said, any social media that you're using on all the major platforms, and again, it's the same thing, it's just Harvey Castro, MD. I'm literally launching on Monday my website, and it's, again, the same. It's going to be harveycastromd.com. But here's the kind of geeky fun part that you'll actually like. I have all these videos, YouTubes, podcasts. I clone my voice for my podcast. There's a way that I created this algorithm where for the last year, any blog that I see, I put into my own SaaS model. It creates a picture, a transcription, a fake conversation between my business partner and I, but it sounds very fluid. And then we upload it. But on the website, I just added a chat bot and it'll be live on Monday. And I have uploaded all the interviews that I can find that are transcribed, all my books, any blogs that I've written. And now you could go to my website and then just have a conversation with my books, with me. And it's just a bot based on all my information. So you can literally, if we have a transcription of this, I can upload it. And then anyone can go and say, hey, James and Harvey met the other day. And what did they talk about? And it'll go through.
Outstanding.
Kind of cool.
So what is the help.ai? What's that project? Is that part of this project?
No, let's talk about it. Yeah, no, I love Help AI. And let me tell you what it is first. Help AI is a large language model, little device that literally sits over the patient's bed at a hospital. And it's got sensors. And the first thing people are like, whoa, it's seeing you. It's not that vision of what it's seeing. It's not being transmitted. But what it does, as an ER doctor, this is dear to my heart, it's helping patients, and no pun intended because it's called Help AI, looking at the patient and are the patient trying to get out of bed, rolling, or are they just grabbing the remote? And then patients that are fall risk, any patient that the camera's on will alert the nurse, the doctor, dashboard, the alarm that goes outside the bed to tell patients, hey, this patient's about to get out of bed. But what's really cool is it literally has predictive analytics in it. So you don't get all these false alarms. It literally is able to know if you're getting out. And they've put all these things into the algorithm to make sure. But the coolest function that I like is that not only does it alert people, it actually verbally tells the patient, hey, Ms. Jones, do not get out of bed. Someone's coming. Give us a minute. And to hope buy us some more time. But what's really cool is we're using AI not only to speak, but to speak to that person's language, culture. So when they register, if they say, hey, they're from Europe and they speak, let's say they're from Spain, they speak Spanish, then the algorithm knows that it's Spanish. And then when it speaks to them and needs to talk, it'll use examples from Spain. And so that they feel more accustomed and more attuned to that. Yeah, it's really cool. And so what I'm working with the CEO, we're working on a new edition and we're going to create a home edition because I keep telling them as an ER doctor, I have found patients down 3-5 days, literally almost dead because unfortunately that loved one fell, could not get up, could not make a phone call, and they were literally stuck there. And so as a result, there's this fancy term called rhabdomyolysis, but basically the muscle broke down, went into their kidneys, put them in kidney failure, and that gets so high, those levels that it can kill them. And so I've seen literally people dehydrated and close to death because of a fall. And what we're creating is a nice tool that will go around the house that will basically alert that loved one. Say, I'm going to make a fictitious example. I have, say my mom is supposed to be getting closer to a nursing home, but she's, no, I'm in assisted living. I'm fine, but I'm living on my own. Then I could set up these devices. And then if, God forbid, she falls or she breaks, this is another part of the AI, she breaks her pattern, then I would get an alert saying, hey, mom's down. She hasn't gotten up today. Or, hey, she fell. No one's been alerted. I want to let you know she's been down for more than 2 minutes. You want to call and find out. And then I can go in and intervene, call 911, call mom, see what's going on. And so I think this is going to save lives.
I agree. There was a startup company we got involved in that unfortunately was probably way ahead of its time. It was probably 15 years ago. But what they did is they put sensors on the toilets, the water, the sensor in the bed, and I believe the stove. And so it was looking for patterns that were breaking, and they would, if they were broken, they would alert the family members so they can give a call or something like that. But at the time, there was, who would pay for this? There was no medical reimbursement and stuff like that. So it didn't quite make it, but it's a beautiful concept.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really honored to be part of this. I'm able to use my AI brain, my ER doctor brain, and then just looking how can we get this to the masses. So I'm a kind of person that I think pie in the sky thing. So I'm already telling the CEO, no, we're going to create all these different products. And then I want to go international as well as just national, because I just think this is going to be huge.
I think talking to an ER doc about this is really interesting, because when you look about the physician shortage we're about to have, and you look at the challenges, particularly in rural medicine, to me, the value of AI is bringing the major institutional knowledge. So if you go to the Mayo Clinic or Mass General or Cleveland Clinic, they've seen every tail of the distribution, right? And all the really unique stuff is on the tail. And I think as our physician, you have to work so quickly, right? When you assess a patient, I can imagine that AI might be pretty helpful in saying, okay, these are the 10 things this could be in addition to your own judgment, and maybe something in there is a little unique.
Yeah, no, I love that you said that, because that's actually one of the examples that I usually give. At the end of the day, I'm human and I'm expected to be working at 100% at 3-4 in the morning. And maybe I'm not a night owl, maybe I'm a day person. But the part that's really tough on our ER workforce is today I may be working mornings. Literally the next week, I may be working evenings, and then the following, I may be working night, and then I may be going on vacation after that, and then coming back and starting again. So the human factor, I'm not a machine. And as much as I try my best to be at 110%, I'm still human. And so here's where AI, I think, can hugely help us. I always say it's AI plus human is better than just human or just AI. And the case in point, with me having 20 years of ER experience, my clinical gestalt is strong, but I'm still human. So if it's 2 in the morning, and let's say I'm seeing you and I'm going through muscle memory and I got it, if I have AI to put on those symptoms here and say, hey, did I miss anything? Is there anything else I should think of? And it comes back and says, hey, have you checked his eyes? Because there's this particular disease, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot to do that, actually. That's a good point. I didn't even think of that as part of the differential. Not that I'm a bad person or a stupid person. It's just that sometimes AI will be able to catch things, and I'm having it as a safe place to say, hey, look at this real quick, and now let me give the best care.
So particularly in ER, where you have, these are always very acute situations, and you go back to our sort of 10th grade science, you had a hypothesis, you test, and it's true, right? If you have, so you're trying to form a hypothesis to get to the answer for this thing. And in some cases where the situation is 1 in 250,000 people, this could happen. It's pretty unrealistic that you're going to start there.
Yeah.
You'll get there, but time is your challenge, right?
Yeah. And I love that you said that, because time is a challenge and language is a challenge. I used to work literally at the airport in DFW that took care of every international patient that came into Dallas that was sick. So if you got sick on any plane and landed in Dallas, you would come to the hospital that I was at always. And what made that difficult is sometimes some of the languages that would come through, I didn't speak. And imagine giving healthcare, and when seconds count, that I still need to get the right translator, get on the right line, figure out the language, and then hopefully pray that person is really good at that language and able to convey those things. And so I'm biased towards AI. I think it'd be great. Now I would love to have that kind of tool. Obviously there's HIPAA constraints and blah, blah, blah. But assuming that you can get that address, man, what a cool tool to help my patients in real time. I'm seeing technology that literally I have no stock in this company, the Humane AI pen. And it's this little pen that can literally translate. So let's pretend you were speaking German. I literally could have a fluid conversation with you right now if I had it. And then you would speak in German. It would tell me what you said. I would say it in English and it would translate it to German to you. And it would be fluid.
So the latest release of the iPhone last week came out with that capability. And I literally put that on my action button, because it moves so quickly. So I think the Star Trek Universal Translator is probably going to happen in our lifetime, which is very interesting. So what's the biggest lesson that you've learned thus far in your diverse journey?
To me, it's stay humble and stay hungry. No matter where I am in life, even if I'm the CEO of some big company or not, I think it's just to stay humble and true to your value and just be consistent. That's the one thing that I've always tried to be that person. And I think that being sincere in what your passion is will always come through, and people will want to work with you more. And leading by example is just so big. And so by staying humble and true to your cause will push you to another level, and people will respect that.
I think one of the interesting things in your journey is that you've probably learned some of your lessons by a difference in perspective. So as you've moved from an EI doc to actually running a multi-facility organization, what sort of views changed for you?
If anything, I understand better the business aspect and the profit aspect. If your particular organization is a profit and it's not making any profit, then it's probably not going to last long enough to keep those doors open. And so I understand the necessary evil of having to, obviously you need to make some money. So that aspect, I get it more now. When you're on the other side in the front lines and you're just working and helping and doing, you don't see anything but what you're doing. So being able to see the other side of the equation helps, because then as I move forward, then I'm thinking, okay, what can I create that is cost effective that will actually help save money on the doctor side or the hospital side and actually make the physicians and healthcare force happier so that they don't burn out anytime soon, so that they can continue to help our healthcare patients out there.
So when we look at healthcare, we've got the efficiency, the cost, and those aspects of it, but the healthcare workers have not had a lot of job satisfaction for probably 20 years and a lot of pressure, a lot of constraints, do more with less kind of thing. My physician friends working more hours and making less than they've ever made. And yet the price of medical school continues to skyrocket. Nurses not having enough time to take care of the patients the way they want. How do you see AI helping with that?
Oh my gosh, this is huge, huge. Believe it or not, by the year 2050, the population will invert, where there'll be more older people than younger people being born. And so literally to your point, we will not have enough healthcare professionals out there to take care of us. And I'm going to throw myself in there because I'm 50 already. So I'm not far from needing the day where I need more and more healthcare. And so I see AI as follows. It's going to make my job better in that I'm more efficient. I'll be happier because if I don't have to, I literally have had physicians that worked for me that have stayed after their shift for 2 hours just documenting because they couldn't document in time. They weren't well versed on behind a keyboard. Some of them have asked me to, hey, can we hire another person just to type for me? And so knowing that AI can help make that physician efficient, that it's not going to cost me an arm and a leg on the administration side to do that service for that physician, that's huge. The other part is having algorithms. Not many people know about algorithms that are out there that help me evaluate my own team that is able to say, hey, nurse X is probably going to quit on you in the next 30 days. And to have that algorithm put that person in my radar and then have a sit down with that nurse or doctor and say, okay, predictive analytics are telling me you're not happy. You may want to leave. What can we do now to make you happy? What can we do so that we can make this a win? And that alone has been shown now to expand those individuals to start working longer. The other part where a lot of physicians again upset at me for saying is, I truly, and I've been saying this for over a year now, I truly see a day that we will have a robot that will be my assistant. And that robot, using this camera that I'm using now, I literally can tell you what your hemoglobin A1C is, which is your average sugar. I can tell you how old you are, what your blood pressure is. And then not only that, this whole conversation, I can do predictive analytics that'll tell me if you're depressed, if you're getting depressed, if you have, even your voice can tell me what your sugar is. And then on top of that, it can also tell me if you have early Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, all with just this camera feed. So imagine if I had that robot next to me that now is my assistant, and then we're having a conversation, and then the robot is able to say, hey, have you considered this in your differential? Or, hey, I'm going to go ahead and make up a list of labs that need to be done. And I can look and be like, okay, got it. That is going to be huge. That is going to help. I know physically, as we get older, it's not as easy to lift someone up. And so nurses typically have really bad back positions because they're lifting patients. We had a robot that can help me assist the patient getting out of bed, walking the patient. That can help save my nurses from retiring sooner because now they're not worried because their back's okay. Like they're not going to have to do anything as far as heavy lifting because we have a robot. So I really see this future coming soon.
So I wonder, we look at the internet and the personalized messages that we get from digital marketing and all that. I wonder if AI can bring back that personal aspect of things by being able to keep this history going. I'm struck by, I did a series of qualitative interviews a few years ago with neurologists that had Parkinson's patients. And what struck me is literally brought me to tears, how these people watch these families, because in many cases, they have these patients for 40 years before they expire. And they're worried about the caregivers, maybe the spouse that's taking care of. And several of these doctors I talked to kept copious notes on the personal details of people's lives that were applicable. And I can imagine that if they can find all that stuff out on us for commercial marketing, there has to be a way to bring back that sort of personal approach so that you could be educated when you interact with someone.
I won't mention the name because I'm starting with this company, but that's one of the projects we're working on. We're working on a project of taking data and then turning around and doing predictive analytics and then on cue based on their voice, how they're speaking, that we can be empathetic back and explaining. So that way we can create that platform. So we're literally working on that. I wouldn't be surprised if we have something like that in the next 3 months.
Yeah, I think unfortunately told the story last week, so it's a little, probably my audience is going to be still telling it again, but I was in end-stage renal disease at a period of time, and I happened to walk down south into a dialysis center. A nephrologist is giving a lecture to this man about he's eating these tomatoes. And he said, I know I'm not supposed to, but my wife has this secret family recipe that she does when these tomatoes are harvested a couple times a year, and it's completely disrespectful for me not to eat it. And it struck me at the time that, you know, how could a physician sort of record that so when the next year comes up and tomato season starts, that he's not only maybe warning the patient, but recognizing that educating the patient has nothing to do with that. It's educating the spouse that's not disrespectful of the family, that this tradition is not good for mom or dad. And I think that's another place where we can get a little more personal and more intimate.
I love that you said that, because on a cultural side, there's a lot of things growing up Hispanic that I don't agree on the diet portion. And I've always had issues with my mom. How do I be respectful, but tell her, hey, I don't want to eat that, or I don't need that, or I'm okay, I'm full, because it's disrespectful not to finish your food. And then just, hey, mom, can you give me a little bit less this time? But it's just interesting. To that effect, I want to explain again how AI would play in that role. I think a lot of life is education in healthcare. And so the more I educate my patient, the more you'll increase the way you behave and behave, have better healthcare outcomes. You may have a better quality of life, and hopefully you live longer. And I really believe that AI will get to a place where it'll be my companion and will be able to see and hear and talk to me and say, hey, that meal you're having has this many calories, has this protein, because it'll literally just be seeing it. And then tell me, hey, this is actually has a component here that you're allergic to, or this will increase inflammation in your body and you may end up gaining weight. So that whole interaction, we're not far from. I know it's here now, but to make it to the point where it's literally my companion that is helping my health, I think we're getting really close.
And I think there's articles that say that a lot of our cost is health illiteracy and teaching people things and access. So you have stories like that. And then you have stories that are, my daughter's a nurse. She works with pregnant mothers in a city kind of area. And she is shocked that she literally had a patient a few months ago that boyfriend told her that if you drank red wine, you couldn't get pregnant. And this was not a teenager. This was someone in their mid-20s. And you just say, how is that education letting the system down? And so the other aspect of this is these tools can allow, I think access is always a big issue, access to healthcare and understanding how to get access. And I think that AI can probably help a lot with that too. So when you look at the next 5 years, what do you see as the biggest opportunity for healthcare in this AI world? Where's the biggest challenge that if we solve it is going to have an 80%, the 80-20 rule is going to have a big impact?
I think if we can do a better job with predictive analytics in healthcare, that will save lives and money. Case in point, NeuroTron and GatorTron are two large language models out there in New York. They're the ones in Florida, and the skinny is. They're using all the data that's out there for their particular healthcare systems, and they're creating predictive analytics so that the healthcare physicians or providers that are their team can look at the patient and say, this person needs to stay another night. This person should go home now. Because it can say, okay, no, this person won't bounce back. This person is going to be okay. And that little tool seems like simple, but having that kind of tool, because I'm combining, like I said earlier, AI plus human is better than just AI or just human alone. If I've had 20 years of my clinical gestalt and I'm like, no, this patient can go home. But then if I have AI behind it, using predictive analytics saying, hey, these are the factors, this is this, maybe you haven't considered X, Y, Z, and then I can trump that or supplement it. Now I'm creating such an amazing patient experience or better outcome And I'm going to argue that then I can save dollars for the hospital, save time and dollars for the patient as well, and have a better outcome.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a clashing of privacy and cybersecurity with this AI issue. So this is vision of a real-time healthcare system, and you realize that 80% of the preventative information is outside of the hospital system. And if you're looking to connect a bunch of Apple Watches and all these systems, if you're the CIO of these institutions, you recognize every connection is an AI risk, right? And we certainly have seen, particularly recently, hospitals being held hostage. But then you have the privacy. So one of the great things about having been part of Carnegie Mellon University and University of Pittsburgh here is the medical center is always working with the AI scientists. And so they ran a project of just trying to predict readmissions, and they had permission marketing. So obviously the families allowed access to Facebook, and they realized very quickly they could see the dialogues among the patients and their postings and get a sense that maybe something was happening. And the result was absolutely fantastic. But obviously that's a huge privacy issue. So how do you see us overcoming that?
Luckily we have HIPAA. So there's a lot of healthcare professional companies that are creating products that are making sure that their products are within constraints, that they're not violating HIPAA. The other portion is that these things start getting implemented at the hospital. The hospital also is worried that they don't want to violate HIPAA. So they're making sure that these devices hopefully are on secure HIPAA compliant servers. Or I'm advocating we need to create models that literally sit on the servers at the hospital level. So that way it's never outside of those servers and it's just inside already what's secured. As we move forward, the other part to this is we need to be transparent with our patients. From a HIPAA and privacy point of view, I'm worried that many patients aren't aware that AI is being used on their health. And we need as a society to be more transparent. And then the next part to this is I'm advocating for what I call like a little AI food label equivalent, where patients can be like, oh, they're using this AI and here's the white papers. And it doesn't have to be super long, but just a page of saying, hey, here are some of the biases, here's some of the good, here's some of the bad, so that they're informed of what's being used. And then I'm pushing that we need to have an AI bill of rights on every patient floor and every room so that patients can be like, okay, this is what's going on. Because if it's being used for their care and they have no idea, then I think that's not right. I think they should be aware. And if they don't want widget XY AI, then they should be able to voice that and explain to the administration why.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting challenge to watch. That's excellent. So what else would you like to share with the audience?
At the end of the day, I want people to be excited about AI. I want them to think of it like riding a bike. The more you ride it, the more you know. And I'm not saying that you have to be optimistic. I'm just saying just take it in so that once you understand, that unknown goes away. And I'm really want to empower people out there listening, like, how can I personally use AI or my organization use AI to help my cause, help my patients be more efficient? And if those questions are something that you want to know about, feel free to call me. I'm literally going around the world giving talks about this. And if there's some particular issue that you're like, look, I really don't know how to solve X, Y in my healthcare system, feel free to call me because this is what I'm passionate about. And I would love to help other patients.
Just for our audience, you have 3 books?
I think I have 15 books now. I have one that's about to be published. So
are they all on Amazon?
Yes, sir. They're all on Amazon.
Okay, so for the audience, I will put that in the show notes. Thank you so much for taking your time with us today. I really appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much for your time.
All
Thank
right.
you.
Take care. Thanks for tuning into the Chalk Talk Gym podcast. For resources, show notes, and ways to get in touch, visit us at chalktalkgym.com.